Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and to prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. This is a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than to compare yourself to others. Now, today, my special guest is an engineer and an author of a book called God Theories. His name is Ken Ungerich, and I will introduce you to him in just a moment. First of all, I'm going to read you his biography, which is written in the first person. So pretend I'm Ken. I was raised on a small dairy farm in northern Minnesota. I graduated from college there in 1968 and taught high school science for 7 years before moving to Baltimore, Maryland in 1975. There I took a 2-year course in electronic engineering. Since then, I've been a trainer and engineer in various aspects of the electronics industry. I'm very excited about being able to retire in a few months and move back to Minnesota to help my brother continue to run the farm I grew up on, do some traveling, play some golf, and renew some very important relationships that I've maintained from the place I've always considered home. But while teaching and engineering have been my life's professions, my passion has always been an open search for greater understanding of the spiritual aspect of who we are. I guess I've explored that facet of our existence, at least on a cursory level, from about as many ways of doing that as there are. That process has led me to conclude there are great spiritual truths that can be found in virtually every religion, as well as from the fields of metaphysics, philosophy, and science. But there are also many ideas from each of these sources that are mutually exclusive and therefore cannot be true for that reason alone. I think that it's important for us to try and do a better job of sorting out those that are truth from those that are not. And so now let me introduce Ken. Ken, how are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you, David.
Well, thank you for joining me. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome. I believe in helping authors. I'm an author myself, and I know how important promotion is these days. It's difficult to get the word out, and publishers oftentimes are not that helpful. So I'm happy to help you out.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome. So tell me, what was your motivation for writing God Theories?
I would say that my major motivation for writing the book was to make a contribution towards the effort of trying to bring a greater balance in the ingredients that we use to put together our spiritual beliefs, faith, passion, and reason. It just seems to me like reason kind of gets a short shrift on things, and so I would, you know, my focus in the book is definitely a focus coming from that perspective, from reason and science.
Well, that's a different take from some of the guests that we've had so far, so this will be a very interesting interview. And I once had a physics professor who said, the more that he found out about science, the more it increased his faith in God. What do you think about that?
I think that's definitely true, especially those physicists that are working at the quantum level. I think they are making some amazing discoveries, and a lot of those are coming to some realizations along those lines, I think.
Would you describe the book a little bit first before I ask you some more questions?
Well, like I said, I think that the main focus of the book is to try and bring a little more reason into this discussion. It contains what I believe, what I contend, are some proofs of some scientifically designed proofs of some important spiritual aspects. And it also then contains, beyond that, speculations that kind of flow out of these proofs. So I do get in a little bit to, some of the social aspects. Religion and politics play a major role in how we construct our society. So I discuss that as well a little bit.
What are those different spiritual aspects that you might be talking about in the book?
Okay, well, first of all, before I get into that, let me just give a brief summary of my core beliefs, and I think it might give people a better understanding of where I'm coming from and where the book might be taking us. So these are just my core beliefs. I believe that life is a gift from an unfathomable complexity that most of us, at least in this part of the world, would call God. And I basically believe that our task is to learn how to receive that gift and to make it fun. I think that is what we're all about. I believe that this is an ever-expanding quest and that the current physical existence in which we find ourselves is but a very tiny sliver of that overall eternal process. But since it's the one that we are currently focused in, it is, for the moment at least, the one that matters. Now, I think that it's up to us. You know, I believe that these spiritual love and wisdom and all of these things are available to us, but I think that we are the ones that have to make it happen. And there's a lot of misery in our world, and I just think that we can do a better job than we have.
What is your explanation for the misery in the world from a metaphysical perspective? Do you have one?
Yeah, kind of. I think religion is a great thing in many ways, but it's so diverse and people get so passionate and about their beliefs that you look at a lot of the things that are happening in the world and I think a lot of that is based on misunderstanding and not being open and tolerant of other people's views. And I think that religion, for all the good that it does do, also has some drawbacks along these lines and that has caused, you know, a lot of the misery that exists.
I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to those spiritual aspects that I was asking you about.
Okay, all right. First of all, if a spiritual aspect is a part of the human condition, as I obviously believe it is, then it would follow that there would have to be a set of truthful principles that accurately describes the characteristics and functionality of that aspect. Now, I think that the obvious complexity of that aspect would pretty much guarantee we're never going to be able to identify all those principles, ever, let alone begin to understand them. But if we can just lay down a few of them, I think we will have a foundation upon which a true spiritual understanding can begin to be built that would literally and profoundly begin to transform our world into the kind of place that I think deep down we all believe it was always meant to be. And as I said earlier, I will contend that God theories does make very careful use of sound scientific principles to prove some of these fundamental concepts. And at some point, I think they will need to become recognized as important and fundamental principles of truth. And these are the following. First, none of us could have come into this world as a result of chance or luck or because we live in a universe that is compelled to produce something and simply wound up producing us. In other words, it's impossible, in my view, for us to be the end product of a mindless, predetermined evolutionary process. An evolutionary process, yes, but one that is driven, I think, at every step of the way by some level of consciousness. So number two, conscious involvement, some of which I believe must have or has to originate outside the physical domain, has to be a part of the process by which each of us do come into this world. Now, I'm not speculating too much on just what that conscious involvement is. I'm not saying it comes from God. I personally kind of believe that we kind of plan our own excursions into the physical. But
It's okay.
Yeah, okay, that was my cell phone.
We deal with multiple phones in this life.
yeah, that's right. I should have turned that off. Anyway, so I believe that, that we are involved in that process, but somewhere it comes from something. Now, the essence, David, are you still there?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, I'm here.
Ken, can you hear me?
David, it's Paula. It sounds like something happened. Him calling in. Ken, are you there? Okay, I'm going to try calling him, okay?
Okay, so. Very good. In the meantime, what I'm going to do is read a description of Ken's book, which is again called God Theories. With black and white rules of scientific and religious theories, is it possible for the two powers of reason to blend and coexist? Ken Ungerich believes they are not only able to coexist, but that they even support each other's founding principles. In God Theories Revised Edition, Ungerich makes careful use of sound scientific principles to prove the following statements to a virtually absolute degree of certainty, and with the belief that at some point they will need to become recognized as important and fundamental principles of truth.
Telephone number 4-3-2-7-6-2-6-0-8. Can't take your call right now. Please record your...
Hello, Ken?
Hello, yes, I apologize.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened.
You're still on here. So, no, you called in and you're fine. Here, so go ahead. It happened.
Okay. Well, Ken, I'm reading a description of your book, and I'm going to read the points here. Well, actually, you have just spelled out those points. I'm just going to say that he concludes with saying, the relationship anyone has with the divine will always encompass faith, and it will always involve passion. It will always be unique and personal, and it will always be a mystery. But it must as well leave room for reason so it can see its way to truth. God Theories seeks to promote a greater balance among the ingredients we use to hold our spiritual views together and the belief that will help us come to a grander, more meaningful, and more truthful understanding of them. And let's see, I'm not sure that you got through all of your points. I don't know if you can pick them up or if you want me to remind you.
No, I think I can pick up where I was interrupted.
Great.
There. Okay. Yeah, I apologize.
Yes.
I don't know what, I'm not sure what happened. Yeah, anyway.
No
okay,
problem.
So number one, we were said that I believe that we, none of us, could have come into this world as a result of luck or chance. Number two, conscious involvement, some of which has to originate outside the physical domain, has to be a part of the process. And number three, the essence of who we are cannot possibly depend upon the creation of a particular physical body. Now, sometimes that's a hard one for us to accept a lot of times. We get so attached to the body we're living in that we think we can't exist without it. But mathematically, it just can't be that. And that must mean, therefore, that we exist independent of that body, and also must mean that we had to exist prior to coming into any body that we currently exist in, and we will continue to exist after we leave it. And therefore, number five, therefore, we're all in essence eternal spiritual beings. And those are the five.
Do you believe that we incarnate in different physical bodies as we move through the spiritual realm?
I do, yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. So do I. And why do you believe that?
Well, I think it's the thing that makes most sense. I think that this physical environment that we're currently living in, we exist in for a number of reasons, primarily to learn. You know, a lot of things about what life is all about, and I just don't think that most of us are going to do that in one lifetime. It's quite obvious, I think, that a lot of us don't do it very well in one lifetime, and I think that probably, you know, is true for most of us, and I think that we need more than one shot at it, and I think we get more than one shot.
So perhaps it's a matter of just rounding out our soul so that we become complete?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think eventually we will probably move beyond the physical, and, you know, I believe that there are all kinds of other experiences that are open and available to us, and this is one of them, and this is one that we need, that we learn to get through, we get through, we get more than one shot at it.
Sounds good. Can you describe what makes God theories unique?
Well, I think that what I just mentioned is one of the things, certainly the most important thing that makes it unique. And but for me, it's not just a belief. As I said, I have a proof in there, and I'm not claiming that I'm the only one that's proven certain spiritual-related things. But I think that the way in which it's put together in the book is unique. Then beyond that, it speculates, you know, on different ideas that I think flow naturally out of these proofs that I'm not claiming are proven. They might be things that I have very strong beliefs about. So this is in essence, I would say, what the book is about and what makes it unique.
What other spiritual authors do you resonate with?
Certainly, I don't know if you're familiar with Lazarus and Seth, Jane Roberts, the Jane Roberts book.
Yes, I'm familiar with Seth, not Lazarus.
Uh-huh.
How about Esther Hicks?
I have read, yes, I've read some of his stuff. Yep, mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Anybody else?
Well, let's see. There probably is. I'm not real good at remembering authors. I'm just trying to think of some of the other ones. Some of the mediums that are fairly well known, and I just can't remember their names at the moment.
That's all right. I just thought that it might provide a point of reference to people that were familiar with other authors.
Well,
and
yeah, again,
that would be able...
Most of the I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. I just thought that it might help people get a better idea of some of the ways that you found truth along your journey and help inspire interest in your book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly started off with the Edgar Cayce material also, so
mm-hmm.
I think that's
mm-hmm.
something that a lot of people do.
Yes, okay. Is there anything else that makes God theories unique?
I would say that is a pretty good description of what makes it unique. Like I say, I do, I believe that consciousness is one of our fundamental properties, and I do get into a discussion on that. Talk about some of the ideas that are resonating along those lines. Now, science has pretty much for a long time, considered our universe to be made up of matter and energy. But we know now that these are really two different forms of the same thing. Mm-hmm. And now that fact, of course, was first put forth by Einstein with his famous equation E equals mc squared, which was very dramatically demonstrated to be true over the deserts of New Mexico in 1945, and again over Hiroshima and Nagasaki very tragically later on that year. So there's no doubt that matter and energy are two different forms of the same thing, and so the real question then becomes, you know, what is the source from which each of these components are derived? And I think that that is a question that a lot of people are contemplating today, and we are, I believe, converging towards an answer. I believe that I have a pretty good idea of where that is, but so I do speculate on in some of those areas as well. In the book.
Okay, let's move on that note. What's the difference between a proof and a speculation?
Okay, well, a proof is designed to demonstrate that something is true. That's its purpose. And it does that using reason and evidence and to a degree of confidence. And I think that that last part is important, that, any proof is only going to be as good as the components that put it together. And it can never be totally absolute. It's always going to be some level of confidence between very low and absolute. And a speculation, is just that. It's an idea that's put forth that may or may not have evidence to support it, but that usually, hopefully, will have some reason to it.
What are considered to be the fundamental components of our universe, and what do you believe they should be?
Okay, well, as I was mentioning, the fundamental components that most people consider to be that make up our universe are matter and energy. And as we've already discussed, these have been demonstrated to be two forms of the same thing, much like ice and water vapor are two different forms of the same thing. So mm-hmm. I said the real question then becomes, what is the source from which each of these universal components are derived? And there are possible answers that have been proposed to this question that come from various sources, including religion, classical physics, quantum physics, and metaphysics. And I would just like to briefly discuss some of these. Now, first of all, I think if we go beyond the fundamental principles that I discussed earlier, and I will contend that those principles have been proven as far as I'm concerned, so let's assume for the moment that they are or need to be established as principles of truth. That means that any thinking that goes beyond them will have to be consistent with those principles. And if we consider religion, most religions, I think, go far beyond those principles, but are all of their conclusions consistent with them? And I would have to say that the answer is no. So if, let's just consider one religion that goes beyond those principles, and that's intelligent design, which is something that we're all familiar with to some degree. Now, I believe that the intelligent designers have done an amazing job of proving that there has to be a greater consciousness that kind of is overriding and guides our universe. I don't know if you're familiar with The Case for a Creator that was written by Lee Strobel.
No, I'm not.
Okay. Well, in that book, I think that he points out a lot of, you know, he puts forth a lot of ideas that are somewhat similar to mine in proving that there has to be a greater consciousness involved in the overall process of how our universe functions. But I think that where the intelligent designers, where they go a little astray is that they try to use that science to promote a particular religion, and in this case, Christianity. Now, I believe that there's a lot of truth in Christianity, but I think that there are some things that we also maybe need to let go of, some ideas that we need to let go of. And one of the ideas of, well, for most, I think Christianity in general pretty much assumes that we do only have one shot, that we come into this life, we were not in existence prior to coming into this life. We come into this life and we have to accept a particular belief, or, you know, we're going to spend the rest of eternity in total misery. And I, first of all, I do not believe that a loving God would set up that kind of a situation. I don't believe that a loving God would sentence anybody to a state of eternal misery simply because they can't come to believe what is essentially an irrational idea. So one of the fundamental principles that I said that I am quite sure is true is that a particular physical body cannot be what we are limited to. Our existence cannot depend upon the creation of a particular physical body. So I believe that this is where the intelligent design folks are not in line with that principle. And, you know, I would not agree with all of the rest of their ideas. But I do believe that they have put forth some very sound theories to support the idea of a greater consciousness being necessary to create what our universe is. So that is one. So that is one area. Now, classical science, of course, talks about the Big Bang. What's really interesting is both the intelligent designers and classical science essentially say that the original source of everything is nothing. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with some of the latest theories in classical science, but that is one of them.
Okay.
That nothing suddenly becomes something, and that this happened about 13.7 billion years ago when nothing kind of condensed into what the material that erupted in what we call the Big Bang, and that all matter and energy was effectively formed within about a hundredth of a second after the Big Bang. I kind of have my doubts about that, but the science that goes back to the Big Bang, I think, probably is sound. Now, quantum physics, on the other hand, talks about something that they call strings. You're probably familiar with string theory.
I've heard of it, but I'm not really familiar.
Okay. What the quantum physicists are saying with regards to string theory is that our universe is essentially consists of a matrix of tiny little vibrating one-dimensional strings, and that these strings can somehow twist and vibrate and spin their way into becoming subatomic particles, such as the fermions and the leptons and the bosons, which are groups of subatomic particles. And the fermions are the ones that there are different groups of them, but one group can combine to make protons and neutrons. And the leptons, one of the important leptons is the electrons. So these strings vibrate and spin and twist and turn their way into forming these fundamental particles, which make up atoms, which then make up molecules, which makes up what we see in our physical universe. So they, so this is one thing that the strings can become is matter, and the other thing that they can become are bosons, which make up all the different forms of energy, electricity, electromagnetism, nuclear forces, gravity, and light. So the quantum physicists would say that these strings are the fundamental source of matter and energy. And that's effectively how they become. Now, most of the quantum physicists, not all of them, but the one, Brian Greene, who's one of the main brilliant quantum physicists and has done much to promote this theory, I have never heard him ascribe consciousness to these strings. I've never heard him, you know, offer an opinion one way or the other. I suspect that he may think they have consciousness, but it's him being a sort of a classical physicist. He does not necessarily promote that idea. But you said that you're familiar with the Seth material.
Yes, I am. I've read several of the books.
And the course, the Seth material came out over 40 years ago. And in that book, he talks about what he calls consciousness units. Do you remember reading about those?
I vaguely remember that, yes.
Okay. Well, Seth's description of consciousness units is virtually identical to what the quantum physicists are talking about when they talk about the strings, the vibrating strings. The only difference, the only major difference is that Seth ascribes consciousness to these particles, whereas the quantum physicists, as of yet, do not.
Okay. For those that aren't familiar with Seth, we should say that Seth is something, is an entity that Jane Roberts, who was a medium, if you will, channeled for many, many years, and with the assistance of her husband, Robert Butts, transcribed this material into a number of books, including Seth Speaks, The Seth Material, and a number of others. She's also written a delightful book that's fiction that might be easier to grasp, and that's called The Education of Oversoul 7. So I would highly recommend that to anybody that wants to explore this more. I think we better move on. I just wanted to back up for a moment and ask you, what do you think the truisms of Christianity are, since there's so many Christians in the world?
What the what of Christianity is?
The truisms, if you will.
Oh, the truisms? Okay, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I believe that Jesus was a real person. I believe that he lived in this world. I think that he was one of the most highly spiritually evolved people that ever has lived in this world. You look at the quotes that are that are ascribed to him, and most of them are very sound bits of wisdom that we probably should take to heart, like love our neighbor and do unto others, and all the things that Jesus is really known for. I just think that his message has been distorted along the way. Yes, I believe that he exists. I believe that he can be a source of strength and love when we need those. And you look at the passion that so many Christians have, and you know that something has to be real there.
Okay.
That's my take.
Thank you. Now, what is a brief description of the anthropic principle that you refer to?
Okay, the anthropic principle, was an idea first put forth by, at least in the present form, or the form that we're most familiar with, that was put forth by Brandon Carter in 1973, in which he basically said that what we observe must be restricted by our ability to observe. In other words, basically what he was saying was that we're not going to exist in a place that we can't exist in. Now, this was put forth to try and explain away the incredible intricacies of our universe and the finely tuned nature of it. In other words, we know that if the forces of gravity and electromagnetism and all of the other physical forces that we have were just slightly different than they are, just microscopically different, our universe wouldn't exist, and we wouldn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But since we do, you know, it's basically, the idea is often put forth in conjunction with the fact that there are probably many universes, and ours just happened to have evolved in the way that it has, and we exist because of that. Now, it's
That's
usually
mind-blowing.
Also, yes, yes, exactly. So, I mean, basically, the anthropic principle is a tautology. It's a, you know, it's a truism, and it's usually also used to explain away the highly improbable things that that basically I also talk about in my book. You know, things that are so impossible that they couldn't possibly be.
Oh, that's great. What is the most common controversial idea that proponents of the anthropic principle claim that there's a reasonable explanation for?
Well, they claim that it is a way of explaining the highly improbable things that we see in our universe. And it's usually used to promote the idea of a universe that does not need any outside consciousness. In other words, a totally predetermined type of universe. That's what it's usually used to promote.
And what's a common analogy that's often used to help understand and validate the anthropic principle?
A common analogy that is used to try and validate it involves the examination of receiving a particular hand from a deck of cards. Now, if someone deals you a 13-card hand from a 52-card deck, the odds of you getting any particular hand are roughly 1 in 500 billion, which are pretty small. Now, the odds of you getting a hand are obviously 1 in 1, right?
Right.
If somebody deals you a hand, you're going to get a hand, okay?
Correct.
So they use that analogy to say, all right, yes, there are people in the world. The odds of any particular person ever being born are obviously very small, but since people do exist, the odds of someone being born are obviously 1/1. So they use this analogy to say, yes, the odds of you ever being born are extremely small, but the odds of someone being born are absolute, so therefore we live in a totally deterministic world or universe.
Why do you believe this analogy can't be used to validate this principle?
Okay, well, first of all, no analogy can be used to validate any idea. I mean, and this is something that I think that a lot of people, you know, kind of ignore when they put forth an analogy. They say, well, this is analogous to that, therefore that must be true. But an analogy can help us understand an idea, but it can never be used to validate one. And I believe that this particular analogy has two fundamental problems. One is that without the application of consciousness, there would never have been a deck of cards in the first place.
Right.
And the second, the biggest drawback, in my opinion, is that the odds that we're talking about of any particular person ever being born is so incredibly small that it doesn't even begin to compare to the odds of, not receiving a particular hand. So I believe that this analogy has two fundamental problems, and the main one, both of them really, one of the main ones is that consciousness was involved in creating the deck of cards. I believe that consciousness is involved in creating our universe, and I believe that it's absurd to think that it was not.
Now, you talked about intelligent design. What are your views on intelligent design in classical evolution?
Well, yes, I have talked about that. As I said, I think the intelligent designers have put forth many very solid examples that illustrate our universe could not possibly have existed the way it does without an overriding greater intelligence. As I've already mentioned, I think that their biggest drawback is that in their attempts to use this legitimate science to promote a particular religion in the way that they do. Darwinian evolution. I believe that their evolution is a pretty well established process, but one of the big ideas that comes from classical evolution is that consciousness is something that came into being in conjunction with the evolution of neural systems in animals, and that is an absurdity, in my opinion. I think it's an idea that needs to be released. I think science is gradually coming to understand that it needs to release it, but it still is promoted by classical science. And closely related to that is the idea that consciousness is something that can only be generated from the of animals. There's a biological, chemical reaction going on in the brains of animals. Now, we know that we can poke and probe and do certain things to the brain and induce consciousness. And so it certainly obviously has a major role in the consciousness that we are using as long as we're in the physical domain. But it cannot possibly be the only source of consciousness. So I think that these are two principal ideas that classical evolution is eventually going to have to do away with. And I think that consciousness will eventually be understood to be something that is a part of everything and is the ultimate source of everything. And this is basically, what Seth was saying. It's also the same thing that Lazarus, who, I don't know, are you familiar with the Lazarus material?
No, I'm not.
Okay, well, his Lazarus talks about a lot of things that's very similar to what Seth was talking about. So Lazarus, his focus is more on how can we use this information to make our lives better. The Seth material is very technical. If you're familiar with that, you know that. There's a lot of that stuff that's mm-hmm. kind of hard to understand. And so Seth dealt more with that. Lazarus talks more about how we can use things. But they both agree that consciousness is something that's inherent in everything and is the ultimate source of everything. So
I find that the material channeled by Esther Hicks, Abraham, is probably the most easy to digest. And one of her basic principles is that has nothing to do with science is that there is absolutely nothing important enough to take us from our joy, and that we should not allow anything to take us from consistent moments of joy.
Yes. I mean, I would totally agree with that. we're all going to come at that joy from different angles. My background is in science. It's what I enjoy. So I come at spirituality to a certain extent from that perspective. But absolutely, what you just said is absolutely right.
Well, it's fascinating. We only have about 15 minutes left, and I have about a half dozen questions left. We don't need to go to all of them, and it looks like we have a caller also. So I will wait to hear what Paula has to say about what the caller wants to ask. In the meantime, let's talk about something that people can relate to, and that's television. Can you explain what the basic ideas are behind how it works?
Okay, yes. I think an understanding of television can help us understand where some of the latest ideas concerning how our universe works goes. First of all, we know that when we look at a television and we're looking at somebody inside that television, we know that there aren't really people inside there. We're looking at an image that is created from an electronic signal on a screen. And we know that on that screen there are little, pieces of phosphorus or LEDs or things that can emit light when they are activated properly by an electronic signal. But we know that in order to be able to, first of all, create the illusion of motion, we need to be able to paint that picture in a different location. In other words, if we can imagine somebody walking across a screen on a television, and let's say that right now that person is on the left side of the screen. That person is painted on that image as a result of the electronic signal hitting the phosphorus dots or LEDs or whatever are used to make up the television screen. And if that person is walking, we know that it's not the dots or the LEDs that are moving that create that illusion. We know that now the electronic signal is illuminating a different set of dots. So we know that television is an illusion. We know that in order to be able to create the illusion of motion, we need to be able to create those images rapidly, and we know that we do that by illuminating different sets of dots, or LEDs or phosphorus dots. Is that clear?
Yeah, well, I was able to follow it as you went along, but it's
okay,
a little bit beyond my ken.
So where that's leading is there are many scientists today who are coming out with the idea that our universe is a big hologram, an amazing, incredible hologram. And a hologram would work in somewhat the same way as a television, but only in three dimensions. So in other words, and we were talking earlier about the strings and the consciousness units, we know that they do not move, but we need something to create the illusion of motion on a three-dimensional scale like that. So what Seth is saying, what Lazarus is saying, and what the quantum physicists are all saying is that when we move through space, what we're really doing is using a different set of strings or consciousness units or whatever you want to call them to create and recreate our physical bodies, if that's what's moving, or whatever it is that's moving, in somewhat the same manner as we create the illusion of motion on a television screen. Now, metaphysicists for a long time have been saying that our physical universe is an illusion. And I think that this is what they're talking about.
Okay. Would you like to take a call? Okay. Paula, we would like to take the call that you have.
Okay. Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Regina.
Hi, can you hear me? Hi, David. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead and ask your question.
I have a burning question, and I'm really enjoying this whole show. I've been a student of the Urantia book, Eureka Institute, and a big fan of Taylor Desjardins also. And you were giving a hint that we may be reaching the Omega point. That's what I was hearing quite early on in your talk. We're going to be at a certain point in time where we make the quantum leap. I don't know if that's what you were referring to, but I would like to know, and could you give us any further clues on what you think your understanding of this point in time is?
I'm not familiar with the Omega point, but I do believe we are at what I think I understand with the Omega point to be. Yes, I think that we are at a critical juncture in human evolution, and I think that we are about to make some big leaps. Yes, I do.
Okay.
Any other questions, Regina?
Okay, but it's not a specific point in time. You just think we're at critical mass now.
I would not be able to pinpoint a particular time, no.
Okay.
But I think that we are moving through a critical point, you know, a period, for sure. Yes,
yes.
I do.
Okay. Okay. Because at one point, Oscar Ocasio in Eureka Institute had pointed to the tarot card. When you read it backwards, it spells Rator, and it is pointing to a specific point in time where we will make that leap. And Chardin, talking about the Alpha and the Omega, is we are going to reach a certain point in time. And so, you know, I'm just hearing you reiterate, yes, there is going to be that point in time in space where we make a decision.
Yes, yes, I think so. I think it's more a period. I'm not familiar with what you're talking about, but
okay.
I think it's a period, a transitional period. I think we are going through it right now. Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much for giving us all this information.
Okay.
Thanks for calling in, Regina.
For calling in.
Thank you, David.
Bye. You're welcome. Ken, question related to that. Do you think that we have personal responsibility in reaching that point?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I think that we're, you know, I believe that we have total responsibility and I think that that our actions are going to determine exactly what, you know, what happens during this period. Yes, I do.
And what can we do to accelerate it? If anything.
Well, I think we can become more aware, more consciously aware of things. We can learn to be happy, learn to have joy. I think that's the number one thing.
Great. Great. What about love?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, that's the greatest force in the world. Absolutely. We need more of that for sure.
So maybe that's the kingdom of heaven that Jesus was talking about?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think there's an enormous amount of more metaphorical truth in the Bible than there is literal truth, and I think we have to kind of dig for it, and that's why, you know, that's one of it. That's one of those ideas.
I believe that, too. It's interesting. I had a conversation with a born-again Christian who takes a literal view of the Bible, and, of course, I take the opposite view. I'm metaphorical. And I believe we need to search for meaning and that all wisdom is within. What's the important idea of the Michelson and Morley experiment? What did that refute?
Well, the Michelson-Morley experiment of 1887, I believe it was, refuted the idea of an ether. Now, up until that point, scientists, everybody, figured there had to be an ether through which matter moved. But their experiment, they set up an experiment to measure the speed of light. And they aimed the light beam in the direction the Earth is moving and at right angles to that. And they figured that the light that was aimed in the same direction as the light as the Earth was moving would travel at a slower speed as it had to buck the ether as the Earth moved through the ether. But what they discovered was the light traveled exactly the same speed in both. And subsequent experiments to that have pretty much shown they were right, and there apparently is no ether through which matter moves. And that, that was a great revelation. But if the quantum physicists are right, and if Seth is right, and if Lazarus is right, then we don't need an ether through which matter moves, but we do need one out of which we could create and recreate at a very high frequency, everything that the Earth consists of, including our bodies, including everything else. And the strings of string theory and the consciousness units of Seth provide us that ether, and I think that's the direction we're going in.
What's the generally accepted idea that that experiment and the theory of relativity support?
What is the generally accepted idea?
Michelson-Morley experiment and theory of relativity support.
A lot of the evolutionists have used that idea. They have said, because an ether has been talked about for so long, and that's always been kind of a nebulous thing. The classical Darwinian evolutionists never really did like it. So when they proved that it didn't exist, they thought, this is the way things work. We have a mindless, godless universe that just sort of follows, predetermined laws, and we live in a totally deterministic universe. So that's fundamentally, that's obviously an oversimplification, but they made use of that idea to support the idea of a totally deterministic universe.
Great. Now, we're going to move a little bit beyond the hour point. So for live listeners, you're going to need to come back in and search the archives to get the end of the show. I'd like to ask, what paradigm shift in how we view the universe is being promoted by an increasing number of people?
Okay, well, this was what I was just referring to, the idea that our universe is a gigantic hologram, that we are amazing holographic images. I believe, now, of course, the quantum physicists are the ones promoting this, but Seth and Lazarus have both essentially been saying it for a long time. The quantum physicists talk about an information horizon point which controls the holographic images that make up our universe. Seth and Lazarus both talk about consciousness as doing it, that we, on a continuously creative basis, create our bodies, for example. We create them and recreate them at incredibly fast rates, which allows us to give us the illusion of motion. And so this is where we are heading, is a convergence of a lot of these ideas that are coming from quantum physics and metaphysics, and that this is a big one.
Well, that's great.
The idea that our universe is a hologram, I think is an interesting idea.
What evidence is there for that?
There is evidence. I think that part of the evidence is the fact that we have, that the string that the quantum physicists are talking about, something out of which we could create and recreate matter. Seth talked about it also. Lazarus talks about it also. So I think that those are evidence. Now, I actually haven't read the article, but I know that there was one that came out just in December of last year that also talked about it, and I do want to go back and read that, and I should have done that before I came on, but I did not.
No problem. Mm-hmm. Well, what were your early views on God and religion, and how have they evolved?
Well, I would have to say that up until maybe I was 25 or so, I would have had to consider myself to be an agnostic. The idea of God, you know, maybe, maybe not, I didn't know. But when I started actually thinking about the proof that I lay out in my book, the impossibility that I could have come into this world without some kind of consciousness being involved was just too overwhelming. So I became convinced at that level intellectually that there had to be something. And since then, I have read a lot of books and you know, done a lot of thinking. My major source of information has been Seth and Lazarus, who I've mentioned a number of times. So I you know, I like going to church. I don't do it every Sunday for sure, but I think that there is something there in most churches that that I can get. But I don't, even though I don't agree necessarily with all of the, you know, the ideas that are put forth in a lot of churches.
What religion do you practice?
Well, I grew up Presbyterian. I would not say that I necessarily practice any particular religion right now.
No, I just wondered what faith tradition you're following.
Yeah. Well, that's what I grew up as a Presbyterian. That's my background.
I see. Yeah. So did I.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, I did. I was baptized as a Congregationalist and became a communicant of the Presbyterian Church. Then I was an agnostic. Then I came to believe in reincarnation and studied a lot of the same things that you studied. And my current path is I currently attend Unity Church, which calls themselves Practical Christianity, but they hold true the truths of all religions, and they do not believe that there's one pathway to God, that there are many pathways.
Yes, I'm familiar with the Unity Church. I have attended that many times. That is, that if I was to follow any particular church, that would be the one. But it sounds like your path was very similar to mine. I went to the Congregational Church when I was a young kid, and then we went to the Presbyterian Church, and then I became an agnostic, and I became a believer in reincarnation, and also attended the Unity Church a number of times.
What's your current concept of God? I mean, this is, you're probably going to be reiterating some of the things that you've said, but if you could summarize God, what would God look like to you?
Well, you know, as I said when I started out, I called it an unfathomable complexity. And I believe that there are mysteries in the universe that are really beyond our comprehension. It's hard for me to even conceptualize what God is. I believe that we are all a piece of God. I think that God is everything, as a lot of religions say. Maybe they, and so I believe that God is integrated within everything, that we are a piece of it. But I believe that it's also more than that. I think that there is a consciousness that is so far beyond our comprehension that we really can't, it's indescribable.
What would you say to an agnostic or somebody that's having a faith crisis?
I would say to, keep an open mind. I would encourage them to search. I would encourage them to be open to reason, to faith, to passion, that all of those are positive things. I would say that in my mind there isn't any question that, that spirituality is true. Are you familiar with Mary Lou McIntyre? I don't think that she's a well-known author, but she has written a delightful book that the name of
No, I'm not familiar with her.
Yeah. The name of her book is Life is Forever, Get Used to It.
I love the title.
I absolutely love that title. And I think if I was to have a philosophy, it would be very similar to that. I believe that life is absolutely forever. I might change the last part a little bit. I might say that, you know, maybe we can do a little better with the rest of it than we've done up to this point. But, you know, that would be sort of a summary, I guess, of my overall philosophy.
What could, should, or shouldn't be said to an atheist?
Oh, boy. You know, some of those people are more fanatic than, you know, a lot of religions. That's a good question. You know, if somebody holds a view so passionately that you can't communicate with them, then that's you simply can't communicate with them. I don't know what would your idea be.
Well, I used to try to get somebody to look at the concept of spirit just through examining things in their life that filled them up with joy. For instance, a lover, a pet, a sunset, a waterfall, a rainbow, just anything that inspired awe in them, and asking them to consider what that is that they're experiencing. Is that something more than just something that's random and uninspired? But I've heard it said that you shouldn't argue with an atheist, that, for instance, if somebody is an atheist and is dying, the best thing you can do is just be there for them and not try to spoon-feed them any of your beliefs. Yeah, that's what I've heard. And coming to see that there's a middle ground there, because my program is about inspiring hope and encouraging people to have an open mind. So my views on that are evolving, on what is appropriate and inappropriate. I don't know. I know that I don't like anybody to force their beliefs on me. That much I do know.
Right.
And that when somebody does that, then my mind tends to close. So I certainly don't want to be responsible for closing somebody's mind to what might be a greater reality. But I think that for an atheist to listen to your program, this program, it could really expand their mind. So I'm hoping if there are any atheists out there that you'll consider what Ken has had to say. And I thank you so much for being with me today. I'm going to have to listen to this interview several times to be able to assimilate it. But thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to say about your book before we close?
No, I think I've probably said most of what I've wanted to say, and I really, really appreciate this opportunity. I think that I've covered maybe even more than I was talking about. And thank you so much, David.
You're welcome. One final question. What's your hope for the world, spiritually and physically?
Well, my hope is that we will eventually resolve the crisis that we face, and we face a lot of them, and I believe we will, okay? It's not an easy thing. We're not going through some easy times, but I believe that we will do it.
That's very hopeful. Thanks, Ken. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing of separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.